There's the big board, the 20 electoral votes from the state of Pennsylvania. We just got new metrics in.
Right now, a historic moment. We can now project the winner of the presidential race.
The inauguration of a president celebrates a peaceful transition of power engineered by the American voters.
The president-elect of the United States of America, Donald Trump.
Donald J. Trump is the president of the United States elect.
This is a political upset of huge, huge magnitude.
Country still divided.
This is your life now. This is our election now. This is us. This is our country. It's real.
All right, hello and welcome, our listeners of the 45th podcast. I am back this week. I'm so excited because I feel like it's been a while since we've had the whole team here, and our team has grown. So first of all, let me say hello to Susan and Sarah.
Hey.
Hi, Rabia.
How are you guys holding up in this heat?
Not going out.
That's one way to deal with it. Susan, how are you doing? I know you've been had a lot on your plate lately.
Yeah, and probably a good time to be indoors anyway, so...
That's true. Well, like I said, our team has grown, and I'm so excited to welcome a hopefully regular new contributor guest, maybe potentially a permanent co-host at some point, if we can coax him into it, conservative commentator Tom Rogan. Many of you, I'm sure, have heard his name. Tom is a very well-known political journalist who's appeared on and written for like pretty much every outlet you can name. He does regularly write for the Washington Examiner and the National Review. Tom's a specialist in Middle Eastern politics and U.S. foreign policy. He holds the Tony Blankley Chair at the Steamboat Institute, and he's appeared twice on the show that I revile, which is Bill Maher's Real Time. I don't revile the show, but I have issues with Bill. But he's also a regular panelist on the McLaughlin Group, and he has a great blog, which I encourage everybody to check out, called Tom Rogan Thinks. It's tomroganthinks.com. It's all about U.S. politics and foreign policy. Tom, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much for the very kind introduction. Good to be with you.
I have a little tidbit to share.
What's that?
So Tony Blankley's kids went to Langley High School with mine, so I used to bump into him at parent-teacher meetings.
Oh, nice. Great. I never got to meet him, unfortunately, but Linda, his ex-wife, is a good friend of mine, so, you know, cool. I'm sure he would.
Yeah, this is the first time actually I've heard of the Steamboat Institute, but their work seems really interesting, and I'm going to check out their speaker series and stuff, so I'm looking forward to that. But, you know, we, so far on this podcast, Sarah has been holding down the conservative fort, so she now has some backup, and, you know, Susan, we might have our work cut out for us at this point. So I'm going to start off this week with just doing a couple of really quick updates, and then we're going to do a couple of issues in depth. It has been a crazy week. I feel like I see this every week.
You do.
I do.
But it's always true.
Really? Is it, or is it getting crazier? I don't know.
I think it's getting crazier, but it's also always true.
Yeah.
We've gotten used to the crazy now.
Yeah. Tom, you appear on the media a lot. Are you just like constantly being bombarded with like requests to interview for these different issues?
Well, I mean, the utility of a British accent, I don't know how much it has to do with my ability to offer anything substantive. I think it's more about the accent. But
I'll be honest. The accent is exciting. It's exciting. But I don't think it's just that. your substantive analysis is fantastic.
Well, thank you. Yeah.
All right. So quick update on the immigration. I mean, this is like bits and pieces every week. Something changes on the immigration executive order, which has been a saga going on for months now. And that's this. Just in the past week, the U.S. District Court, you know, last we talked about this, the Supreme Court had basically announced that they would be hearing the case in full in October. And they had, you know, given the administration a bit of a win. One of the U.S. district courts, which had ruled on the case, didn't really undermine the court's decision. But what they did was they kind of leveraged the Supreme Court decision by saying, okay, fine, there are certain issues they've ruled on, but what I can still do is expand on the family definition, because if you guys recall, the people coming in from these six countries, the administration was requiring that they show a bona fide relationship, and the Supreme Court upheld that, the bona fide relationship. But the list of family relations was pretty narrow, according to the administration. So this court expanded on it, includes grandparents, in-laws, aunts, uncles, cousins, meaning if you're a visitor from one of these countries, you're coming here on one of these visas, those six Muslim majority countries, and you have any of these relations, that would qualify as a bona fide family member. But what the Supreme Court then did was they upheld the administration's request to strictly enforce the ban on the refugees from these countries for now. So a bit of a win, a bit of a loss, but these issues are going to be, I think, painstakingly, one bit by bit, litigated over the next six months at least.
Good update.
All right. Next, new big news. There's a new communications director at the White House, and his name is Anthony Scaramucci.
Did we ever clarify why the old one left? Dubke?
Mike Dubke? Nothing's
ever clear anymore.
Yeah. I mean, I'm assuming it was just, I don't know. I mean, what I've heard is that it was just, you know, it was just too much pressure, overwhelming. I mean, but I don't think there's been any overt suggestion that, or he never made any statement saying that he had any explicit issues with the president or his agenda or anything like that.
But no one quits being the communications director of the White House 6 months in unless something's really going on. That's not like a normal career move by any means.
Unless his job is kind of defunct because the president does his own communications.
There's that. Yeah, it's hard to be a communications director when you don't really have control over the comms. But the other thing is what we've been hearing for months is that, you know, there's a lot of just internal battles at the White House. And I don't know, Tom, do you know anything about that?
Well, I think the interesting thing is that that you see this, just the constant infighting, that none of them seem to trust each other. Those that have sense isolate themselves from it. So Jim Mattis at Defense would be the best example. But obviously, H.R. McMaster, the National Security Advisor, seems to be under fire at the moment.
And Sessions, too, who we're going to talk about in a bit. But, you know, I mean, personally, I think, you know, this kind of like everybody like kind of being pitted against each other, I think it has to do with Trump's leadership style, where people have to vie for his, you know, his personal attention, being his favorite, not being unfavored. I don't think he's good at managing teams of people where everybody feels like they have legitimate space and power. And
I think it's more than that. I think that there's a blatant disregard for the system. And so people, like, you know, they're at loggerheads with each other because he wants it a certain way and he doesn't really respect the system. And so they have to mold themselves, and that's just not possible most of the time.
I would argue his style is actually extremely effective for a reality TV show host.
There's that.
Yeah, I mean, the drama, the infighting, that's all excellent television.
Yeah, that's true. There is like a Hunger Games kind of vibe going on in there. But, you know, Anthony Scaramucci gave his very first White House briefing on Friday. I mean, apparently the decision was made the night before. He was at the podium the very next day. So let's just listen to a bit of that briefing.
Predicted the president will get a win in health care. That's my honest prediction, just because I've seen him in operation over the last 20 plus years. The president has really good karma, okay? And the world turns back to him. He's genuinely a wonderful human being. And I think as the members of Congress get to know him better and get comfortable with him, they're going to let him lead them to the right things for the American people. So I think we're going to get the health care done. I also think we're going to get tax reform done.
And so what do we know about him? What we do know about him is he's a Harvard-educated lawyer, and he comes from a career in Wall Street, Goldman Sachs, Lehman Brothers. He launched his own hedge fund called SkyBridge Capital, which, interestingly enough, he actually sold it in January to some Chinese interests so that he could specifically apparently work for the White House. But the job offer did not materialize. He expected to get an offer because during the campaign, he actually acted as a surrogate. He did fundraising, campaigning for Trump. And the offer never came. And I guess in the last few weeks, as Trump has gotten more frustrated with communications and not really having somebody permanent in that position, because Sean Spicer has been filling in since Mike Dubke left, he hired this guy and nobody knew it was coming. Not even Sean Spicer, not Reince Priebus, not Steve
Bannon.
Well,
they knew they were fighting against it.
Well, apparently, according to a very recent report just this morning, it was a total surprise when he walked in the door on Thursday to Sean Spicer. Like he knew that there had been a visit to the White House 2 weeks ago by this guy.
But not gone through.
But not that he would actually be offered this position. And yeah, I mean, Sean Spicer resigned over it. That's kind of big.
Has anyone else had Bohemian Rhapsody stuck in their head ever since this happened?
Has what?
Bohemian Rhapsody.
Bohemian Rhapsody?
No, I've had the Lebanese Deb case stuck in my mind.
So what are your thoughts on this guy?
That the sense of just sort of basic disrespect that they should, that the president seems to be comfortable with, that you would, you know, you have your press secretary who is essentially a whipping boy, and then you would simply throw this curveball at him. And, you know, I think there's some kind of, it's the first time I think someone in the Trump White House has actually kind of said, you know, I mean, literally, enough is enough, and being a pushback, whatever you might think of Sean Spicer, but the idea of just the basic lack of civility, which, you know, perhaps is not surprising to people, but you would think maybe the president would be, you know, more deferential, or not deferential, but more sympathetic to civility in, as it pertains to the people who he works with.
I think when Trump made the call not to bring Spicer with him to meet the Pope, that kind of signaled where everything was going. I mean, he took, like, well, who's Scavino, his, like, Twitter troll. And, like, that's all Spicer wanted. And he was denied even that. He should have known, he probably did know from then, that you're never rewarded for your loyalty in Trump land.
Right, right.
Well, I think I will miss Sean Spicer, to be honest. I mean, like, I kind of got used to him.
And we have SNL skits.
The SNL, yeah. I mean, you know, he's putting Melissa McCarthy out of a role there, but I'm sure SNL will pick up this guy very easy and quickly, because I don't think he's going to be hard to parody. But, you know, let's see how it goes. I think the briefings are going to continue to be very interesting and entertaining. He seems like a very, very big fan of Trump, although in the past he has been a little bit, more than a little bit, he's been critical of Trump, but his tune has changed. Now we're going to move into a couple of deeper discussions. This week, Sarah, I want to talk about two issues. Number one, she's got an update for us on the healthcare bill, which was big, big news earlier in the week. And then some ongoing debates with the Iran nuclear deal under Trump. So, Sarah, I'm going to turn it over to you now.
I touched on the healthcare bill last week. It's interesting to see how that played out. So we do know that the CBO came out with its score, which said that it would still have the 22 million people that will be uninsured by 2026. And it was kind of sad to hear about Senator McCain. I saw some really, really nasty tweets and, you know, kind of social media posts about people just getting really visceral towards McCain and, you know, wishing horrible things upon him once he's, you know, diagnosed with a cancer. And I just thought that was really sad and distasteful. But I think that kind of held up the process by a day or two for McConnell, who kind of waited for the surgery, the eye surgery that McCain was going through. And so it was like an extended drum roll for a bit. But then, of course, the inevitable happened, which was I don't think the bill had the Republican support that it needed. And it was mainly two Republicans, Mike Lee of Utah and Jerry Moran of Kansas, I guess, who kind of broke the tie or sort of defected.
Who held hands and jumped in together?
Well, I don't know if it was simultaneous, but I guess
it was. They neither went alone. They had to wait for the other.
Wow. Well, you know, it already had people like Rand Paul and Susan Collins of Maine, who didn't even want to get to the point of, you know, kind of thinking about a debate over it. So it didn't have the support like we had talked about last time that it needed. So I just wanted to give a brief roundup of that.
I keep seeing a headline, though, that there were three female Republican senators that had a lot to do with.
That was for the straight repeal. After they had, like, I don't know, the failure number, I cannot keep count. After one of the failures, they decided to go with a pure repeal option, no replace.
That's right.
And that's when they're like, no, sorry.
I think one misunderstanding that liberals probably have about Republicans is there are many Republicans, and also including the working class that supported Trump in the elections, that really don't, you know, do believe in Medicaid expansion. And some of these Republican senators do have them in their states. And that's always been a stumbling block, because there are people who are sort of middle of the road that do feel that there are elements of Obamacare that need to stay for the health and well-being of our citizens. And I think those are probably the ones that had more leverage in this bill as well.
Yeah, and I think it's going to be interesting to see now what happens with tax reform, you know, whether tax reform, which is going to be the big push now, is focused on, you know, getting rid of major deductions in return for rate lowering, so mortgage interest deduction the Washington Examiner, we spoke to a member of Congress, Ron DeSantis, last week, or this week, and he suggested that those elements would probably be the two that would stay. But secondly, whether the idea of a revenue neutral tax reform package will come through, or it will be, or will it be one that actually increases the deficit, at least in a short to medium term.
That's a fantastic point, because I was talking to Rabia last week about how local elections are being affected in terms of the tie between the healthcare issue and taxes, because a lot of these local leaders are trying to figure out how they can, you know, deal with the tax issue in order to accommodate allowing people more disposable income to be able to buy healthcare and bring the prices down. So, yeah, you're right. Healthcare and taxes very, very closely tied. And at one point, I think we were all wondering if they were going to handle or tackle the tax issue before the healthcare reform. But I guess the push was for the healthcare reform to go through first.
I think they've lost a lot of important political capital on the healthcare fight. I think it's going to be a slog to get anything done here.
Yeah, and that's I was thinking.
Yeah. Trump is going to tank it at every turn because he has no idea what he actually wants. And he'll constantly be, you know, spouting out random lines that make no sense and undermining any sort of coherency.
He delegates it. I mean, it's not him who's going to articulate what he wants. It's got to be everyone putting it together, and they can't seem to.
But his public statements are going to undermine whatever they do come up with. Like him talking on healthcare every time he talks, he like gives a new plan out there.
Right. Sarah, don't you think it is a reasonable expectation for us to think that the president should have more specific like policy points, more specific like ideas about how to restructure any of these things? I mean, instead of just saying, hey, just do something, instead of, you know, it almost seems like he just wants to push back on Obamacare because it's called Obamacare, because it was an Obama thing. He doesn't care what it looks like. It's just like this really superficial win that he wants without any regard for details. And I don't think
healthcare costs $12 a year. He doesn't know what healthcare is.
Tom, what do you think about like the, are you hearing that the GOP is going to put aside the healthcare issue right now and focus on tax reform? Or are they still? It seems like Mitch McConnell is still kind of focused on this and saying, no, we're not leaving this. Like the next week or so, they're going to try to come up with another vote.
I think it's dead. I think they behind the scenes, effectively, they've given it up. I think there's a lot more optimism as well that Republicans are closer together on the basic outlines of tax reform.
Okay.
Simplification, lowering of rates. Beyond that, we shall see. So, but I think there is, much more possibility for them on that, and always was, than on healthcare. So, I think healthcare is kind of dead, at least until after the recess.
Well, who knew it was going to be so complicated, right?
I think they might, after they get a little more clarity on the tax reform front, they might revisit this in a more
and get a win, and maybe get a win, right?
Well, who knows.
Who knows? All right, so moving on.
All right, so the biggest thing that's been on my mind has been the Iran nuclear deal, because I think, again, that was one of the main things that the administration or Trump had said in the campaign that he wanted to get rid of. He called it the dumbest deal ever and really ran on that platform in a very, very strong way because, as you know, Republicans are generally, as a group, opposed to the Iran nuclear deal. So the latest developments that have happened, obviously we know that the U.S. and Iran have had absolutely no formal direct diplomatic relationships, no embassies, none of that stuff since the 79 Iranian revolution that got rid of the Shah. But this past Monday, Trump actually very kicking and screamingly kind of agreed to certify that Iran is actually complying with the agreement that was put into place under Obama. And he did this, though, and that's what looks kind of bad on the world stage, is he did it very reluctantly and kind of seems like he's doing the same thing as he did with healthcare, which is like, I want to get this and I don't care what you do, just do it for me. And it's all, you know, pushing people around to get it done and not looking at how and, you know, how it should be done. So the administration has now slapped about 18 new sanctions on individuals from Iran and also organizations or businesses. And that was Tuesday, the day right after he declared that they were in compliance. And he cited the reasons being that Iran was testing ballistic missiles and that it had these awful activities in the Middle East that were undercutting any positive contributions coming from the nuclear agreement. He keeps saying, and rightfully so. He keeps saying that it's undermining U.S. interests in Syria, Iraq, Yemen, and Lebanon, and we can get into that later. But essentially, the larger picture is you actually have this really weird proxy situation happening. On one side, you've got Trump kind of sitting aside with Putin, chatting about stuff in a friendly way, sometimes having meetings that are not on the record. And at the same time, you know that this situation with Iran kind of signifies something that looks like a new Cold War. And even Dmitry Medvedev has said that it's like the new Cold War because you have the U.S. supporting Saudi Arabia and the Sunni bloc, and then you have Russia and Iran on the Shiite bloc in the Middle East. And so in a way, it's kind of a strange relationship, as is most of the stuff that happens these days. But I just wanted to...
I just wanted to ask you about that, because this is one dynamic that I'm a little confused on when it comes to Trump's relationship with Putin and his seeming willingness to work on such a broad range of issues from Syria to cybersecurity. Is where does Iran fit into this? Is that something that has ever been commented on, like in terms from the administration to say, well, we have issues with Russia's, you know, work or support for Iran? Or, I mean, like, is that even like a bone of contention?
Well, that's the weird part. The weird part is that if you look back, Russia has these historic agreements with Syria that allow it access to the waterways and different agreements over oil and stuff. So it's a key involvement for Russia in that area. And so I'm not sure if Trump looks at it as though, look, I get that you have a business interest here and we have our business interests, so let's talk, you know. But I just don't see how, if you look at the general landscape, you can have – it does look like a proxy for the Cold War. It does look like there's two blocks going there. And it's amazing to me how they still manage to talk in favorable ways given that strain right now, because Iran's got a huge hand in what's happening with Hezbollah in Lebanon, and that seeps into Syria, and it's got a huge hand in what's happening with the Houthis. And now we pretty much gave Iraq – to Iran by invading the country in the first place. So,
Tom, what are your thoughts about this, about the fact that Iran doesn't seem to come up when it comes to Russia talks?
Well, I think that to some degree, it's that the Russians have made their bet with Iran, and the ability of the United States to influence Russia on that is quite limited. I mean, what the Russians want is a continued very close trading economic relationship with Iran, a growing relationship there. They agree fundamentally on Assad, albeit for different reasons, in Syria. So there's relative coalescence. And it, you know, it's much harder for the United States to influence Russia on Iran versus, say, influencing Russia on Syria. Although, since we've abandoned the rebels, we don't have much influence on Russia and Syria anyway. So, I think the focal issue here with Iran is going to be 90 days from now. What is going to happen? Is Trump going to sign this again? And also, because of what Iran does on the front of terrorism, you know, the Obama administration was willing to close a blind eye to that in order to assist the Iran nuclear deal and in order to keep that going. And some people say, well, that's realism and worthy. Others would disagree. What happens when they do their next big attack plot, whether it succeeds or not? Trump at that might simply shred it. So I don't think the deal is safe for anything more than 90 days.
Tom, do you think the U.S. is doing what Europe is doing essentially, which is to separate the nuclear agreement from the Middle East involvement or regional interests of Iran in the Middle East, because they just want to tackle one thing at a time and they'd rather deal with a denuclearized Iran than, you know, have to mix the two things together?
Well, no, I don't think the U.S. is doing that. And I just don't see how you can do that, because the nuclear dimension, you know, if we're saying, if, you know, absolutely right, that denuclearization is important, but it cannot be
separate.
It cannot be used as an excuse by Iran to do whatever they want in every other regard, not simply because of what that means for you know, the Middle East, but how the Saudis would respond. If you don't, so for me, the approach is for the United States has to be realist balancing of power politics, because if you don't have that, the Saudis will go nuts and start throwing money at Salafi jihadists again, and the politicized sectarianism just spills out of control. if you try and compartment these issues too much.
No, I agree. I agree you can't separate them. That's true.
Susan, you were going to say something?
I was thinking more about North Korea and how they're watching all of this, and they're like, what's the point? Even if they were so inclined to make a deal, what's the point? It's
That's
not
going to
be worth paper it's written on.
Hmm.
Well, I mean, the difference is, I mean, look, what the deal is holding at the moment, right? The Iran
deal. For now. But Trump keeps saying he's not going to hold it up. I mean, it's in danger.
Yeah, but I mean, it's in danger, I think, partly because of Iranian behavior as well. It's not simply Trump being, you know, trying to play difficult. I mean, the Iranians, the ballistic missile research they are doing, there's only point to do that, and they're doing it very aggressively, is to build a capacity to put a nuclear warhead on a missile. That's a real concern that I think, you know, we have to face up to. And frankly, I don't think, you know, the Obama administration were concerned about that, but they let it slide. I think you can fix the. I tend to think you can still get the Iran deal to work, but you have to you crack down on that ballistic stuff. And I suspect that is exactly what Mattis, McMaster, Tillerson, the sort of, you know, the, let's say the realists in the cabinet, or at least Mattis and McMaster.
You mean the adults?
Would want to do as well. Part of Trump threatening to rip it up actually does give the United States more leverage with the Europeans to say, okay, you know, let's crack on this. Because the European impulse is simply to say, who cares? We're back in there with, you know, the major contracts in Iran that are very lucrative, and, you know, just push, kick the can down the road.
Hey, Tom, I'm curious to know, because I know that we're talking about, like, us pulling out of it or us abandoning the agreement. What if, and I know that Iran decided not to dispute all of the sanctions and kick up the dust more, but what if Zarif, who's the foreign minister of Iran, what if Zarif or what if Iran in general just pulls out themselves? What could happen then?
Well, you know, the Iranian more moderate bloc, as I call them, you know, Zarif, Rouhani, I don't see them pulling out. I think they know.
They're smart. They know they'll play that. You know?
It's critically important. But your point is well made in the sense of the hardliner elements, right? And a big lingering issue here that I think is going to become much more prominent is Ayatollah Khamenei is dying, and there are big power struggles on the hardliner front to take over. And again, they do want to get rid of the deal. They see it as the nuclear element is kind of peripheral, because they would be happy to get their ballistic technology before building a nuclear weapon, because the weapon is irrelevant without the ballistics. Mm-hmm. And that's a few years away. But the issue is when they may try and create an incident with the United States to scupper the deal now.
They could appeal to that joint committee. How does that work? I don't even know how that works.
Well, I mean, I think if they tried to scupper the deal, it would be through, you know, a terrorist attack or an incident in the Persian Gulf with a U.S. Navy destroyer, that they would try and, you know, kill Americans to make Trump then pull out on their terms. And it's a very hard balancing act deterring them from doing that kind of thing in the first place, as well as the only way to deter them from that is to make them think the consequences would not simply be on their terms, that the retaliation would be significant enough that, you know, don't do this.
So you don't think it would be them just saying, we're pulling out of it, we're not interested, we're going to go ahead and enrich whatever. You think it's actually going to be a violent episode?
Yeah, well, yes, because that's the only means of power that the hardliners have to be able to affect the deal, because they don't control the political side of the government, which, whatever you think of Khamenei, and I think he's a quite unpleasant person, but he has granted Rouhani a lot of space on that issue. The IRGC elements, you know, hardliners do not. They don't hold the political cards on that as much as they would wish that they do. So their only other way then to do it is to do something against the United States, which causes the United States to then pull out.
So Sara, you still want to go into a little bit of background right here?
Yeah, I just wanted to run through. So the Iran nuclear deal of 2015 is an agreement between Iran and a group of world powers. It's mainly the permanent five members of the UN Security Council, which is the US, the UK, Russia, France, and China, plus Germany, and also the European Union. And going back into the history of how this built up, it starts off mostly, I would say, you know, it is what it is since 1979. But under Bush, it was in 2002 that Western intelligence and the Iranian opposition, like a group, found that there was a covert nuclear site in Iran. The UN's IAEA went ahead and found that there was enriched uranium in that region, and it could be used for processing or producing fuel or nuclear warheads. And as a result, you know, since that time, there have been, you know, accusations of hidden evidence of experimenting with nuclear warheads. Then you have the invasion of Iraq, which started to strain relationships between Iran and the U.S. even more, because Iran was accused of helping the Shiite militias that were in Iraq at the time. Then in comes Ahmadinejad, who was one of the most amusing characters I've ever come across in the world political stage. I used to literally...
Have you met Trump?
Well, that was, I don't know, it's a new level of entertainment.
We win on that one, yeah.
Yeah. But actually, when he arrived, the nuclear program picked up steam, essentially. And he was an extremely overtly belligerent person. But in the meantime, he went back to enriching uranium at that point, even after, in 2006, P5+1 tried to curb the program. And then at some point you have, when Obama comes in, you know, this is the first time that we're seeing signs that there's an attempt to kind of come to the table. I mean, right before Bush left, I guess they did try to get into the talks a little bit more than usual. They used to be kind of standoffish, but they started to engage a bit more. But it didn't really break through until Obama. And that was the first time, I guess, since 1979 that you had like the powers actually come together and meet. And it was like a one-on-one meeting of Iran's top nuclear negotiator with someone very senior in the U.S. diplomatic corps. And of course, Clinton was the person that was overseeing this at the time, and pretty much started to lay the groundwork for a sort of agreement that was specific to nuclear weapons. And by 2012, Iran's still kind of ratcheting up its nuclear plans, but then you have a slow kind of softening with and this is what strikes me, because I remember what Tom just said about the Khomeini. I was like, he actually publicly declared that the country's nuclear program is peaceful and that it's against Islam to have one.
I remember
that's
that.
Not yeah. peaceful. I was like, that sounds so contradictory. But anyway, so, you know, here's another thing. Qatar played its kind of traditional role of trying to be the place where everyone comes together. But they actually tried to get U.S. and Iranian officials to meet in Oman to see if they could actually start laying groundwork for an agreement. And this was without the knowledge of all of U.S.'s allies, and that includes Israel, who obviously is very afraid, not just now of direct threats to its safety and security, for which it has the Iron Dome, but also now Iran's involvement in Lebanon and Syria, which is an increasingly big problem for Israel. But essentially, it was around, it was September 2013 when Rouhani, who was the current president at the time of Iran, and Obama actually spoke by phone for the first time. And then they started to lay the groundwork for this agreement. And, you know, there's signs of pushback from the Republicans in the U.S. Going back to March 2015, which was right before this agreement. It was led by Senator Tom Cotton of Arkansas. He sent a letter to the Iranis saying that nothing can go through on an agreement, because I guess they thought it was imminent, without Congress approving of it. And it kind of like Obama was sort of upset about that, called it unconstitutional. And I guess the Iranis were kind of like, where'd that come from? Or not so much where did that come from, but how do we deal with this? Because that's obviously they're just going to be dealing with the administration and not having the U.S. Congress on board as well. So it was July 14th, 2015, when all these world powers came together with Iran and they signed a long-term comprehensive nuclear agreement. And that's the agreement that we're talking about right now, which Trump is having trouble shirking off and actually not being able to redesign. And I think his dynamics are a lot different given what's happening in the Middle East right now too. But the pressure is on him from that Sunni bloc in the Middle East, pretty much.
Well, Sarah, you mentioned earlier, I mean, that we've heard this so many times, that, you know, Trump constantly said this is the worst deal ever. It's the worst deal ever. I'd, like, rip it up first day in office. What about this deal does this administration, like, really oppose?
Okay, so I think it has everything to do with the current dynamics. And I'll let Tom chime in on this, too. But obviously, I think given what Iran has done in terms of its involvement in Lebanon, Syria, what it's doing in Yemen, and how it's controlling Iraq, I think there's a real fear. And I've been talking about this for a while now, for years and years and years, saying, you know, this the Shia-Sunni thing is a real thing. And I think that Trump now has chosen the side that he's going to be on very overtly, even if the U.S. was doing that, you know, kind of quietly for years. Now it's out in the open that we support Sunni Arabs. And so I think he's trying to find this nuclear deal to be the mechanism by which to curb Iran, because he's literally saying point blank, do something to make sure we can enforce something on Tehran, you know, do something, or I'm going to go with ballistic missiles rather than specific nuclear stuff. So he's finding ways. And this is what's amazing. We've seen another fracture between Tillerson and Trump, because now you have him trying to take away powers from the State Department and Tillerson and kind of putting it onto his national security advisors and his staff at the White House. And unfortunately, again, for him, even the White House staff, McMaster, Mattis, all these people are vouching for trying to hold on to the agreement for now. So that's what's interesting about this.
So, Tom, how do you see this playing out?
I think it will go one of two ways. Either the Trump administration can get the Europeans on board to increase their enforcement, essentially, of ballistic missile technology issues, which are not actually in the Iran deal, but fundamentally focus on it, and or the deal will collapse. I don't see how that you or again at the end, you know, the hardliners in Iran might do something to scupper the deal. I don't see though how it keeps going if the Iranians are simply very aggressively going for the ballistic missile technology, because in that sense, the two go together. I don't see how it. I'm skeptical that it can endure.
It can hold.
Yeah. Hey, Rabia, though, do you do know that even within that White House stuff, and I guess Tom can speak to this too, there's, you've got Steve Bannon, the chief strategist of the White House, and Sebastian Gorka, who are sort of pulling the president one direction, along with John Bolton, who was up for so many positions.
But okay, to be fair, I don't think you say Gorka is actually pulling. He's just on TV yelling about stuff.
Yeah, but these are people that have his ear, right? And on the other hand, you have Mattis and Tillerson, McMaster, and all these people. So even within that staff, there's like this tug of war. There's this push and pull going on between what they need to be doing and how they're going to couch this in order to curb Iran, whether, like Tom said, it's going to be more focused on the ballistics or specifics of the actual Iran nuclear deal. So either way, it's like, what can we do about this? But how can we use the nuclear deal to do something? So a quick review of what Republicans generally feel. I guess they feel that this nuclear deal is no good because Iran can actually, according to the deal, resume a nuclear program within 15 years. And then the freezing of assets has allowed us to kind of it hasn't been significant enough to stop Iran from getting involved in other stuff. So also unfreezing it, which it did briefly and on and off, has been slight loosening of the sanctions, has allowed Iran to get more control of, I guess, sort of economies that it wants to get into. For instance, the $3 billion Boeing airliner deal that kind of keeps 18,000 American jobs afloat. So it's kind of makes the U.S. or Republicans feel that we're vulnerable. And also, I think their largest argument now is exactly what I said that Trump's is, which is that, you know, Iran's got a close tie with Bashar al-Assad in Syria. It's been responsible for a lot of the billions of dollars that are going to him to prop up his government and supporting militias to him. Also funneling things through Lebanon and Hezbollah and increasing, you know, the threat to Israel. And of course, there's Yemen as well. But I think their fear is that these sanctions don't punish them enough, and that you have to sort of think about the ballistic missile program also, because that's probably more of a threat to the Arab states in the immediate area. And of course, there's a whole Israel argument, which is that, you know, Iran already has a foothold in Syria to a large degree, and they're not very favorable towards a ceasefire. Israel, that is not favorable towards a ceasefire that Russia and the U.S. just agreed to, because it sort of allows Iran to get a foothold in the area. So, you know, Israel doesn't have fear of just direct attack anymore. It's all that seeping influence coming in from Lebanon and Syria. So this is where Republicans stand on that deal right now. But let's see, like Tom said, whether it holds up.
All right. Thanks so much. I learned a lot, and I actually did not know that there was even any news attached to this issue that you know, started off with that this
been
past
big
Monday.
In the last few days. Yeah.
Oh, goodness. There's so much going on. But thank you. I really appreciate that. All right. So, two things that I want to talk about this week. Number one, I'm going to start off with the White House Election Integrity Commission, which is actually something that I have had on our scripts for the last like 3 or 4 weeks, and I keep moving it to another week because there's so much stuff happening. This week, I'm finally getting to it, and I think it's good timing because this past week, the New York Times and the Washington Post both had very big, major editorials on this issue, and I'm glad they did because I think it's a really important issue that folks might not know a lot about. So I'm going to give you a little background about what's going on here. So earlier this year in March, the president created something called the Presidential Advisory Commission on Election Integrity. He did it via executive order, which he loves to do. And what he did was he cited a provision of there's something called the National Voter Registration Act from 1993, which has lots of different requirements of the states. One of those requirements, the states have to maintain accurate voter registration lists, you know, the voter rolls. And citing that, what the commission then did was, and this is very haphazard, that's one of the criticisms here, but very haphazardly, sent a letter to 44 of the states asking for copies of their voter records. And some of the information the commission asked includes the individual's full names, addresses, dates of birth, their political parties, the last four digits of the social security numbers, if that's information the state has. Basically, they're asking for all the information the state has. Different states have different requirements as to, like, you know, what information they have that they can make public. One thing that is important to note is the commission's only asking for the information that could ordinarily be made public. So they're not asking for something that a person couldn't get, but what they want to do with it. Oh, they also, by the way, want information on felony convictions, information on whether they're registered to vote in different states, which is not that uncommon, military status, whether they live overseas, et cetera, et cetera. You can go on and on. What they're trying to do with it, the information is this. They want to take all this information from 44 states and cross-check each other to see if people are double voting, if they are double, triple registered, if there are people voting who should not be voting, like people who are deceased, and things of that sort. So,
who's paying for this?
I mean, it's a federal commission, but it is taxing the states right now, and I'm going to get to that in a minute. And, you know, they also want to use this data to check it against federal databases. Now, here's the thing. This is just raising all kinds of red flags. Number one, many of the states are pushing back and they don't want to turn over the information. There's about 10 lawsuits now to basically get injunctions against this and not have to comply with this request. One of the big concerns is that this could end up producing a lot of false positives that might result in people's names being purged off of the lists, right? So let's say they get the names of a voter and for some reason the date of birth is not matching up correctly. They might consider that as some kind of fraud happening and then purge the name from the voter registration. So when the person goes to vote, their information is no longer there. So, you know, they want to do the name matches, but first of all, it's important to note they don't need all that information they requested to do the name match. And then I mentioned earlier the editorials that were published this week. The Washington Post editorial, these are some of the concerns that it raised. Number one, that this entire effort was announced in a real hurry. It happened 2 days after the firing of Director Comey. Half of the members of the commission had only been selected. It's led by two Republicans, and it is packed with the nation's, some of the nation's most notorious promoters of voter suppression. And that is the big, big concern, how this information will be used to purge voter rolls and as a mechanism for voter suppression. Another big concern is that the vice chair of this commission is the Kansas Secretary of State, Kris Kobach. And he is very well known as a voter fraud alarmist. He believes in requiring proof of citizenship at voting booths. He believes that people vote twice regularly. He really thinks that voter fraud is very prevalent and widespread when all evidence seems to indicate otherwise. And he also has his own matching program that he created. But that matching program has been proven to have a high rate of errors. I mean, this it's called Kobach's Interstate Voter Registration Crosscheck Program. It's had over 200 false positives for every actual double registration. He's been sued multiple times because he's made it really hard for people in Kansas to vote. And so at this point, what's happening is DC and 44 states are refusing complete compliance. There are some partial compliance. Some are reviewing it, but a lot of the damage has been done because, number one, what's happening is that election offices are overwhelmed now with this request. It is taking a lot of time, money, energy to get the commission this information. They've had to spend a lot of time compiling detailed responses to the letter. And one state official actually told the Brennan Center for Justice that his office spent 50% of his time, half of his time in recent weeks, instead of getting ready for upcoming elections, actually responding to this request. A commissioner has resigned. And then last week, the White House made a really odd move by publishing the addresses and phone numbers of people who expressed concern over the privacy of their data. So another big fallout of this request is that thousands of people are now asking for their names to be removed from voter registration. So people are saying they're not going to register anymore, and they're asking for their names to be withdrawn, which is maybe the intended consequence here. I don't know. So thoughts about that, Susan?
Yeah, I mean, I think you're giving too much credit to Kobach for saying he actually believes that there's kind of this kind of voter fraud going on, because it's pretty transparent what they're doing, what the system they're trying to use actually does. And again, it overrepresents exclusions for minority voters. I mean, the whole goal is to like make the voter pool as small as possible and tilt as much as possible towards Republican voters, where you don't need to appeal to the majority.
I find it fascinating how the states are pushing back, and it's a prime example of how our system's set up, where, you know, you can't have something top down just come and everyone just agrees to it. I think it's great.
I think my takeaway here is that there are the voter fraud is much more of a local issue than we think, that it's not some generic. It depends very much on the local officials who are managing it in an area. I'm working on a story at the moment about Chicago and voter fraud there. And you know, the source I'm working with is, you know, really showing me some really interesting, you know, concerning stuff. But
does that include redistricting, Tom? The issue of redistricting, because a lot of that's tied together with voter fraud.
It doesn't, but I think one of the fortunate things on redistricting, which frankly is a lot more important, is that the Supreme Court, the judiciary now is taking that up, taking cases up at a higher level. So I suspect, maybe I'm too optimistic, I suspect that, you know, 2 years from now, we will see a lot fewer issues with gerrymandering, but you know, maybe I'm just, you know, too optimistic on that.
There's some movement now. I'm not sure I'm optimistic, but there's some movement where there's none before.
Yeah, it seems like for Democrats, gerrymandering's the bigger issue at a state local level, and now for Republicans, it's the voter fraud thing. So they both seem to be having a little.
Voter repression is a big issue also for Democrats. I mean, this is issue that
ID requirements. That both seem to be pushing for that. And yes, in Virginia actually is one of those states where, like Tom said, it's gone up to the Supreme Court.
Well, you know, one of the big concerns I have on this, about this, and other than the actual specifics, is kind of like the broader signaling here, which I feel like we keep seeing repeated over and over, whether it is undermining confidence in the court system or the media. Now, I feel like this administration through this commission is undermining confidence in the election process. And I want to listen to a little bit of audio by Kobach to illustrate what I'm getting at.
The commission is to look at the facts as they are and go where the facts lead us on voter fraud and threats to the integrity of our elections.
So, again, you think that maybe Hillary Clinton did not win the popular vote?
We may never know the answer to that question.
How do you say we may never know the answer to that question? Really? Really? You really believe that?
Well, what I'm saying is, let's suppose that the commission determined that there were a certain number of votes cast by ineligible voters. You still won't know whether those people who are ineligible voted for Trump or for Clinton or for somebody else. And so it's impossible to ever know exactly, if you took out all the ineligible votes, what the final tally would be in that election. You can obviously, based on the data, you can make some very educated guesses.
So are the votes for Donald Trump that led him to win the election in doubt as well?
Absolutely.
So, I mean, what do you guys think about that? It's like, I feel like people are removing their names from there is also already a vast swath of people who think their vote doesn't count anyways. I feel like this is really, really going to undermine the confidence people have in our election system.
You're getting into that whole thing of the popular vote and then the electoral college thing, which is a whole other segment.
Like, no, that's what Trump is so thin-skinned. He wants to prove he won the popular vote. And he's undermining his own election by saying that, maybe Hillary didn't win the popular vote. Well, maybe you didn't win the electoral college vote in that case.
Yeah. I think he would be afraid to hear that, yeah.
Because I feel like, Susan, you bring up time and time again how so many things that are happening are undermining our democracy. And this is a democratic process that I think is being undermined by questioning whether or not, there is like such widespread voter fraud, whether we can actually trust the results of our elections. And I have concerns for that. I mean, when you go from fake media to not trusting our courts to now this.
Well, wait. I'm going to give you a little bit of pushback and say, is it so wrong for us to make sure there's no voter fraud and like criminal stuff happening at local levels? Is it so wrong for us to keep a check?
That's a lie to cover up strategies that are designed to reduce voter turnout.
Yeah, and that's the difference. The difference is who it's coming from and how it's being instituted and how it's burdening the states. That's not the way to do it, maybe. But I don't think you should attack the concept that we need to keep a tab on whether or not things are going properly at the local levels.
And that's presuming that there aren't, and they are. And so that's my problem. It's like, again, this is
I think every state varies.
This is kind of like the immigration ban, where it's like we're creating solutions for problems that don't exist. Yeah. We have institutions. There are watchdog groups. Like we know what the rates of voter fraud are. They're very low. But Tom, I'm looking forward to your piece. When is that going to be published, by the way?
Probably not for another month. I'm still working on the sourcing and detail on it. But I'm a little more skeptical than you are about some of the watchdog. The problem is at a local level that the watchdogs are, essentially the same people who are creating the issues. But I think it's criminality that I'm concerned about here. So there are, safeguards to address the issue. The problem is vested interests for a long time, just insulating.
And the far bigger problem, numerically speaking, is the more direct electoral influence through hacking, through other types of election interference, and that they're doing nothing about. The idea that you're going to that comparatively voter fraud is the harm here is absurd. But look, Trump's already told us where he's going with this. He already announced last campaign he's not going to accept the results of an election where he loses. Like, if Trump manages to hang in there until 2020, he will not step down no matter what the numbers are. It will be a fight then. It was, but what about a fight this time?
He'll be dragged out of the Oval Office. The institutions would not allow.
So you have confidence there. I don't, because institutions shouldn't have allowed us to have a president that doesn't know what health care is. But it did.
The military would simply refuse to order. They would refuse to follow orders. I know, quite a few. I think I have a pretty good, for all their failings, of which there are quite a few, senior officers take their fidelity to the Constitution seriously. So
I'm hearing similar things coming out of Justice in terms of, the prospect of Mueller being fired is that there are officials saying that, well, we're just not taking orders from this White House anymore. But here's just what I want to say to listeners as a last thought on this specific issue is this. Please do not unregister. Please do not withdraw your registration. In fact, register if you haven't. Help other people register. And I really recommend folks checking out a website called unhackthevote.com, unhackthevote.com, because it has great tools. Those tools can help you make sure you are registered. They'll tell you where you're registered, where you would vote. It has contact information for your state election board and legislator. So you can you can, on a local level, urge them to have state and local audits of the elections. It'll help you find carpools to go vote together, and also has a tool and a mechanism to report problems voting. So if you're, for example, turned away. So it has a lot of great tools, had a lot of articles too. But please, people, register. Do not withdraw. I mean, like, this, we are handing away our democracy by refusing to be part of this process. Going to move on quickly to the next thing that I thought was pretty big news this week, at least when it comes to criminal justice. This week, Attorney General Jeff Sessions announced a rollback on an Obama-era policy that had been designed to curb something called civil forfeiture, specifically something called adoptive forfeiture. And let me explain a little bit about what that is. This is what civil forfeiture is, and I'm taking this information from Politico, but it's being reported widely. You can find lots of information online. What this allows is it allows the government to seize your property, the property of a private citizen, based on only suspicion that that property is connected to a crime. So, for example, you get pulled over by a cop and you've got a lot of cash in the car, cash that the cop thinks is like, that cash must relate to something that's not legal, okay? $5,000, $10,000, $15,000. This has happened. They can take that cash. Now, they can take that cash even though you haven't been convicted of anything. But if they think there's some criminal activity happening that you're connected to, the cash is connected to, the asset is connected to, they can seize that. You don't even need to be convicted. And then after the property is seized, and this is like a complete reversal of how the American justice system is supposed to work, the owner of that property has to prove their innocence to actually get it back. This system has a lot of abuse in it because of, you know, the power that it gives local cops. And in 2014, the Washington Post did an investigation that found that police nationwide seized $2.5 billion in cash, just cash, not forget other assets, from over 60,000 people since 2001 without any warrants. So thousands of these people had to fight long legal battles, years and years, 5, 10 years, to get someone or even all their money. And because of this abuse, what happened was three states, North Carolina, New Mexico, and Nebraska, completely abolished their civil forfeiture laws, okay? And 14 states adopted a conviction. Then under Obama, Eric Holder announced in 2015 that, you know what, the federal government's going to put a new limit that curbed the government's use of civil asset forfeiture, because this is what was happening. As the states were getting more restrictive and more protective of individuals' rights, you know, in terms of their property being seized, what state and local law enforcement was doing was using a federal law. It's called adoptive seizure, that allows under federal law, if not state law, to seize an asset and transfer it to the federal government, but keep 80% of it. So it's kind of like a kickback in a way. They get to keep 80%. They circumvent the state laws. So what Eric Holder did was basically put a halt to that. Now, what Jeff Sessions just did this past week is that he announced that he is going to reinstate adoptive seizure. Even in states that have strong laws limiting asset forfeiture, law enforcement can now get back around it because of this new policy guidance. And what Sessions is claiming is that, you know, allowing law enforcement to do this it'll strip funding for criminals. It's going to deter crime. Strangely enough, I don't know how he's making this connection really, but the Deputy Attorney General Rod Rosenstein kept repeating when questioned, like, what was the purpose of this? He said that it would help with the opioid crisis. So the reason I feel like people really need to have a heads up on this issue is because, you know, I've given you some, like, you know, basically how these laws can work, but two specific cases I'll give you about how these laws can really destroy lives. In Massachusetts, there was a case in which the federal government teamed up with state police. They targeted a family-owned motel called the Motel Caswell. Now, the prosecutor said that the motel was subject to forfeiture, the entire motel, because guests who were staying there committed drug offenses in the privacy of their rooms. So the motel owners, their motel got seized. Now, they ultimately won in court, but it took them 5 years of litigation to get their motel back. And if they didn't have free legal assistance from a nonprofit called the Institute for Justice, they never could have gotten it back. Another case, a couple named Terry and Rhea Platt, elderly couple. Their son was pulled over in a car because the windows were tinted too dark. The police found cash in the car and a small amount of marijuana. So the police took the cash, but they also took the car. The car did not belong to the son. It belonged to the elderly couple. Okay. It was like one of their only assets, like a poor elderly couple. And you know, they had to go to court for years to try to get the car back. So this is the way in which, like, this can really hurt ordinary citizens. Imagine you have a home, any asset, property, because, by the way, very explicitly in this new policy, Sessions has actually encouraged and said that, you know what, the assets of people, and this is in quotes, where title or ownership lies with persons not implicated in legal conduct is also fair game. So if I own a house, that's my asset, and somebody is in that house, let's say a guest, or let's say a teenager smoking pot, whatever it is, I mean, like some kind of criminal activity, doing something online that's criminal that I don't even know about, that I have no connection to, I'm not implicated. If it comes, if it happened in my property is in any way attached to it, it can also become fair game for seizure.
Wow.
Okay, I went on for a while just to give folks the in-depth background about why this is a big problem, why I was very upset at this news. Tom, are you following these things? Are you following these kind of issues domestically?
Yeah, I think it's interesting in the sense that it's one issue, I think, that has a lot of unity between Republicans and Democrats. And I think you're going to see conservatives.
Okay. Oh, unity in which way?
Yeah.
Unity in opposition to what Sessions is doing. I think you are going to see a rising chorus of voices from the right talking about this. And certainly in the Washington Examiner, our editorial team, when we discussed this week, everyone was in agreement that it was wrong. For the basic principle, you know, we talk individual liberty. I mean, however you might frame it, you know, government overreach, absence of judicial review in a timely manner, seizure of private ownership, which is, you know, I think private property very important to conservatives and our notion of individual freedom. So, it's, I think this is. I mean, it is pure big government overreach. And I think as conservatives, we have to be very clear to stand opposed to this, at least on my point of view, because, you know, the only real excuse for supporting it would be, well, because it's the police and conservatives tend to support the police, as I think we should in a lot of cases, you know, that's fine.
Law enforcement coffers make a lot of money, millions and millions, exactly. Off of this. Yeah.
To me, this absolutely reeks of the sort of, I'll say, kind of the atmosphere, the personality of this administration. It's like this bullish attitude towards solving things, where we kind of bulldoze stuff and don't even look at what actual conservative values you'd be toying with, which is, like Tom said, it would be the individual rights, property, due process, all of that. I don't see how this would fly, and I think states would push back on it. But it's really sad how much time and money is going into the litigation process for the people that are involved in these things for stuff that is sort of removed from them in stark ways.
Like litigation can bankrupt people, and they have to prove that they're innocent. It's completely backwards. But here's the thing, you know, I mean, Tom, you're both right. I mean, there is already a pushback from conservatives. We've got a couple of bills that have been introduced that would restore the presumption of innocence. And one is by Representative Jim Sensenbrenner from Wisconsin. He's reintroduced something called the Due Process Act. And then Senator Rand Paul from Kentucky has introduced something called the Fair Act. So these bills are in play, and they actually could help curtail these expansive, overreach powers that Sessions has just granted law enforcement, which, by the way, you know, he did this in a room, kind of a small announcement that he had, but he was surrounded by law enforcement leaders, and those law enforcement leaders were like, yeah, you know, we've just been waiting. Give us a signal so we can continue, so we can start doing this stuff again.
But it really puts people like us in this weird spot to say that we have an attorney general that's kind of pushing for stuff that is not representative of even just our conservative values. It doesn't make you feel any safer. It doesn't make you feel like you would be able to identify with what the administration's trying to achieve. So it just adds to that. And it's sad because, like I said, you want to find parts of the administration that represent true conservative values. And instead it's all this, like I said last time, kind of renegade stuff that spent so much time fighting against, and money and resources.
Well, I want to take the odds on Jeff Sessions' timberland in Alabama being seized for his perjury.
So actually, that's a perfect transition. I wanted to actually play some audio right here about Sessions being a little bit of hot water with the administration for exactly what you just referred to.
Joining me now, MSNBC national security contributor Michael Schmidt, who was a reporter for the New York Times, who interviewed Donald Trump tonight. So, Michael Schmidt, let's get into that meeting. A couple of beats. The headline, of course, out of it, say Donald Trump saying he never would have appointed Jeff Sessions to be attorney general had he known he would recuse himself. Did you get the sense that he's saying that because he didn't understand that Jeff Sessions had involvement in the Russian issue, or that he thought that Jeff Sessions would be in a position to cover his back, essentially, in that job?
I'm not sure. He did not explain exactly why he felt that way, but he's clearly very disappointed in Sessions. He clearly sees this
almost
as
a... And we've heard reports before that Donald Trump was disappointed in Sessions, and it seems that the disappointment does stem down to just that one thing, that Jeff Sessions is not in a position to weigh in on this Russia investigation.
Oh, wow. Where did you find this gem?
Oh, it was everywhere.
It was on New York Times when he decided to give his rambling interview to them.
Yeah, that interview was crazy.
See, this is the thing. We're all exposed to different things. I've been consumed by all the foreign policy stuff, and that's interesting.
But here's the thing. When he said that, what we know now is that for at least the past, I mean, probably since January 20th, Trump has known, or at least since the time that Sessions got confirmed, Trump has known that Sessions committed perjury when he claimed that he had no discussions with Russian officials, and in writing claimed he had no discussions with Russian officials about campaign-related matters. And yet he's left him as the attorney general for this long, and expected him not to recuse himself, despite the fact he committed what seems transparently a crime. And his concern now is only because that Sessions did something marginally ethical and recused himself from the case.
Do you think that's what it is? I hear. Well, actually, yeah, you might be right. But here, I thought the timing on all this was curious, right? So Trump gives us, he gives this interview to the New York Times. A couple of days later, there's this leak, which happened just actually this Friday, stories published about, you know, this leak of that intelligence intercepted the Russian ambassador speaking to, I guess, his higher ups or Putin back in Russia, telling them very explicitly that he had conversations with Jeff Sessions during the campaign about U.S.-Russia ties. And that's exactly what Sessions testified that he had not done. So 2 days after Trump gives this interview where he's like very clearly not happy with Sessions, this news comes out. I have a feeling he had a heads up this was going to come out. He already knew it, but it wasn't public.
He had to have known forever. Right. I mean, this is not something you don't tell the president. Trump has known from the very first day that his attorney general committed perjury in his confirmation hearing. And what I thought was interesting, too, is that this has been boiling for a very long time. If you recall back in the very start of May, they had, you know, Clapper and the ex-acting attorney general, Sally Yates, testified. And there was one interesting exchange they had there that I think is relevant now.
I want to discuss unmasking. Mr. Clapper and Ms. Yates, did either of you ever request the unmasking of Mr. Trump, his associates, or any member of Congress?
Yes, in one case I did.
I can specifically recall, but I can't discuss it any further than that.
You can't? So if I ask you for details, you said you can't discuss that? Is that what you said?
Not here.
Okay. Ms. Yates, can you answer that question? Did you ever request unmasking of Mr. Trump, his associates, or any member of Congress?
No.
And based on other answers that Clapper gave at this hearing, it's clear that he did unmask someone who was a member of Congress and also a Trump associate, both as one person, which, there's a few options there about who it could have been, but it seemed it was Sessions, and yes, it looks like it was definitely Sessions. So that is why the whole unmasking controversy happened, because they had these intercepts of Kislyak telling, you know, his bosses in Russia that, by the way, I've talked to someone very important, a senator who was like tied to Trump, and here's what he says will happen if Trump wins. They needed to know who that was.
This is why this Mueller's investigation is going to be, I don't buy into the idea that it's going to be a multi-year thing, because the speed of which leaks and, you know, that it's like the iceberg, right? We're seeing the bits that we see are concerning, and the stuff that is below the surface, the 90% that sometimes comes out in rumors, it's, you know, is much worse. And the reason that stuff hasn't leaked to some degree is because the person who would leak it wouldn't simply be leaking classified material. They would be they could be charged with obstruction of justice.
Tom, what do you think about this particular leak? People are saying that it could not have come from Mueller's team.
It did. Mueller's team isn't leaking. They seem solid. There's nothing coming out that seems it comes from them.
So where could this have come from?
I don't know. Mm. It's some former Obama official. Could it have come from the White House itself?
No, I don't know. There's no way it came from them. Unless
I get the impression that there have been consistently groups of people who have been leaking stuff from the get-go. I mean, you see all these little renegade kind of individuals kind of writing in social media and hiding behind social media profiles that are leaking stuff. So it could be, who knows where it's coming from.
It could be from Congress or Senate. I mean, we know Comey told them, because Comey, it's his hearing. He said he had stuff on Sessions. He knew Sessions had to recuse himself, but couldn't say why. Then he had a private session. He clearly told him that then. Like, this is a sort of a widely held secret at this point. So the number of sources it could have come from we know is multiple sources. What seems to have happened is they had a couple sources, the Washington Post did, and for about a month or two now they've known, but apparently recently they got a couple more sources to come in, and that was enough for them to publish. But this has been building for a while.
Am I the only one that feels this way? Because I was reading a foreign policy piece when I was looking at the Iran situation, and it went into things like, and three unnamed sources from our side of from foreign policy or from this place went into this private meeting, and they cannot be named, but this is what they said. I mean, I'm feeling like there's so much of that going on right now. I don't know what to think is real and what's not. It's so much for fake news.
Well, I think
right?
The president pretty much confirmed this is real news because he tweeted out.
No, I get that. It's just that this whole atmosphere. Yeah.
Well, here's another question I have for you guys, and that is this. What do you make of okay, so the president has known about this, right? He's also, it's not like Jeff Sessions just recused himself. He recused himself months ago. Why? What was up with the timing in the New York Times? Why do you think right now is when he's saying, he's publicly expressing his displeasure with his attorney general?
Because the danger's getting closer.
Yeah. Mm. Yeah. The wagons are circling. I also think that's why Spicer chose to jump as well, partly.
And also, like, one insult too far, plus everything's a disaster.
And the president lost his lawyer this week, right?
He lost his spokesman, his legal spokesman, and his lawyer.
Do you think everybody senses the danger?
Guys, I told you this from the beginning, okay? The system, you got to put some faith into the system. And more than the system, the individuals.
I don't buy it.
Okay, the system's screwed us up here.
If not the system, you have to put faith in the American people that there are good people up there that look out for our country and don't do the things that they're not supposed to be doing. And I think that's showing. People are falling like flies.
I don't think you can call the system working when this much damage has been done to American standing in the world. I mean, just because we don't all die in a hellish nuclear fire doesn't mean
it needs to be given time to work.
Sarah, we don't know how this is going to play out. We don't know what this is going to look like. If he gets impeached, if people get... I mean, he's already talking about pardons, right? He's already considering like how he can pardon all these people.
Complete pardons.
Yeah, but if he does the pardons, he's getting impeached.
Really? See, I would have agreed with you. I've lost all faith that this will happen now. I have lost all faith that they can stand up. The Republicans in Congress right now can stand up to what's happening because they've had every opportunity to not allow this massive, horrific train wreck occur. And every single time they have backed down, they have sold their souls over and over again. What's to really, I mean, why are you so confident that this time they'll find a spine?
Yeah, why do you think so, Tom?
Because I think they're waiting, you know, you look at the Senate Select Committee on Intelligence, the Republican senators there, they are letting the process play out. They are not actively trying to obstruct, or even mildly. You know, they're not. There are things they could do without being, you know, prosecutable under obstruction of justice to slow this process down, to screw it up, to help Trump. They're not, and I think they're
letting the system work.
Congress is actively interfering, though. Look at Nunes.
There's also right. Well, I think that the top element is Burr, the Senate side, and I don't see it. I think when it gets to that impeachment level, which I think it will, but let's see if it does. If he starts pardoning people who have been accused of things, it would be so destructive to...
Or firing Mueller.
As opposed to everything else he's done? I hope to God you're right. I hope to God you're right.
Yeah, I hope you're right, too.
I think all this stuff builds. And, you can say, well, what... You know, but at this point, there hasn't... I don't think he's done anything that would be impeachable at this point.
Well, it's not out. As in it's not out yet. Or it's not fully. Yeah, it's not airtight.
Has not been fully fleshed out.
I guess my concern is he's been so transparently destructive and deceitful on so many levels, and they've endorsed that. At this point, if they do turn against them, it'll be admitting that they supported someone who was actively trying to destroy our nation. And that's a hard thing for anyone to admit. For a politician, maybe impossible.
I think it's hard to say he's... I wouldn't agree with you that he's trying to destroy the nation. I think he just doesn't care. I think he sees the nation itself as one and the same, and that if he succeeds, the nation succeeds. I don't think there's sort of malevolence. I think he's just not terribly rational.
But he would destroy our constitution if it helped him, which I would consider the destruction of our nation.
Yeah. Self-preservation is the priority here. I mean, let's not...
Yeah, absolutely. But I think he sees himself as the nation, right? I think there is a...
I agree with you there.
Well, thank you guys so much for the discussion. One thing, John McCain has been diagnosed, I believe, with brain cancer. And so, thoughts and prayers go to him. I think that's also going to... Him, being back on the Hill is going to also have a big impact on these issues going forward. Any last thoughts, guys, before we wrap up?
It was refreshing hearing Susan say, I actually agree with you on that, to Tom. Good to hear the reverse.
Yeah, no, I think that McCain, will effectively, because his time is numbered, and, he's always made a piece on him this week. He's my sort of political hero. I think he is going to be taking a tap. I mean, you've already seen on Afghanistan, again, I think yesterday or Thursday, he railed against the White House because they haven't given him a review they promised.
Right.
So I think, there are good people in Congress who I think Trump cannot escape from.
Yeah.
I agree. Thank you.
Awesome.
Bad people, but I mean,
they're also bad people.
and I would agree.
We could have ended on a happy note.
But... Nunes is someone who,
Nunes
may have some trouble over the horizon with some of his campaign finance arrangements.
Lovely. That's another episode, right, Rabia?
A lot of stuff keeps getting pushed off, but when it unravels, we'll get to it. Thank you guys so much. You guys have a great weekend. We'll be back next week all together to discuss what happens in the coming 7 days.
Great. Nice being with you.
Thank you, guys. Thank you, Tom. It was a pleasure.
Thanks.
Thanks for tuning in again this week, and we really hope to keep coming to you weekly, but in order to do that, we do need your support. So please consider becoming a patron of the 45th Podcast. To do that, just go to our Patreon page. It's www.patreon.com/45thpod. Again, that's patreon.com/45thpod, and Patreon is spelled P-A-T-R-E-O-N. A big thank you, of course, to everybody who helps make this show possible, beginning with our fantastic sponsors. Thank you for supporting us. Thank you to Ray Gaines for our audio production, our kick-ass producer, Mithal Thelhan. Thank you. You are the best. We have been produced by Long Arc Digital Media, and you can find us on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. Our handle is @45thpod. Please do check out our website at www.45thpod.com. And you can reach us and leave us your listener messages, which we love to check into, at 202-670-8345. Again, it's 202-670-8345. Thanks again. See you guys next week.
He thinks healthcare costs $12 a year. He doesn't know what healthcare is. He thinks that this bill is going to provide lower premiums and cover more people.
And I agree with you. Traditionally, the president, when there is like a gridlock, traditionally when there's a gridlock, they do kind of throw out their, look, I want X, Y, Z at least. Now go work out the details. And that's what we're not seeing. So, yeah, I agree with you on that.
He has no details. It's like we elected a bag of marmosets to be our president. If it like squiggles to the right, we're going to call it one thing. Squiggles to the left, call another. But really, it's just like random movements in the corner that we're trying to like ignore.
Well, he's also got a lot of side noise happening, so I don't know what his priorities are right now. So.
his priority is to get better coverage on CNN and all the other channels.
That's true.